In 2008, in an office, one person sits at their empty desk and does nothing. Just staring away into space while all around her people are busy working. Every now and then someone will ask her, what is she doing? Thinking work, she replies. The next week she spends her day in the elevator. People come in, people come out, and she remains in the elevator, going up and down all day. Every now and then, someone will ask her, what is she doing? Thinking again. Employees begin to whisper to one another, is she all right? Does she need help? A spectacle can happen in the most ordinary of places and times. It turns out this woman, Pallavi Talala, is an artist who is creating a performance piece called The Trainee. The whole purpose of the piece was to create a spectacle which would challenge all the busyness around her by refusing to engage in it. To do nothing in the middle of busyness subverts all that hurry. It causes unease, threatens the busyness. Maybe it gets people to rethink. Why are we so busy? Why does doing nothing seem so scary? Some artworks, particularly performance art, are designed to push us out of our comfort zones, to challenge what we think is normal. Now, of course, a lot of us have been pushed out of our comfort zones at the moment, as we've been all forced to experience what it's like to do less, stay at home, have our normal lives overturned. And I think this can be a really hard but also a really important space to sit in and reflect on. Jenny O'Dell writes in her book, How to Do Nothing, she says, every person who by refusing or subverting an unspoken custom reveals its often fragile contours. For a moment, the custom is shown to not be the horizon of possibility, but rather a tiny island in a sea of unexamined alternatives. The death of Jesus is the greatest spectacle of them all. Jesus stands before Pilate in the grand palace of the late King Herod. He stands before a man most people consider to be a powerful man, a man who can decide whether to execute a prisoner or save them. And yet when Pilate questions Jesus, saying, "Are you the King of the Jews?" Jesus replies in a rather curious way, "Yes, it is as you say." Pilate looks at Jesus and thinks, he doesn't look like a king. There he stands, bruises already forming on his body from the guards who have just beaten him before bringing him to Pilate. He's weak, and yet strangely calm. Pilate is uneasy by this prisoner standing in his midst, and so he passes Jesus on to Herod, declaring he's Herod's responsibility. Herod is keen to see Jesus. He has so many questions for him. But Jesus does not satisfy. Like Pallavi Talala, he just sits there, staring off into space, resisting Herod's curiosity, resisting his power by simply refusing to answer. Herod is hoping for some great teaching, for some spectacular miracle that he has heard Jesus can perform. But he ends up being disappointed. Nothing happens. He thinks, well then, Jesus is nothing. So Herod starts to mock Jesus along with his soldiers. This man is no prophet, no king. It's all a bit ridiculous. At least pretend to play the part, Jesus. He drapes Jesus into an elegant robe and sends him back to Pilate. There's all this noise around Jesus. The religious leaders are ranting and raving, calling for his death, laying out the charges. The legal system is scrambling together, trying to appear as if it's functioning well. These two powerful men don't know what to do with Jesus. They're ready to release him when the crowds erupt, calling for Jesus' death. "Crucify, crucify him," they shout. Pilate, this powerful man, finds his power slipping out of his hands as the crowds howl at him. He loses control of the situation. The pressure is too much. So like many good politicians before and after him, he appeases the crowds. He grants their demand. And in all that noise, there is Jesus, silent, watching, letting this show of so-called justice expose itself and to revealing itself how fragile it is. There's no justice here, just mob justice, just a politician doing what a politician does, protecting themselves first. A violent revolutionary is released, and Jesus is sentenced to crucifixion. The spectacle becomes visible to the city as Jesus is led out of the palace and through the streets. He's weak by this stage. He is struggling to carry the horizontal bar, which a criminal would normally be required to carry. But they get Simon from Cyrene and command him to carry it instead. A crowd with a lot of women start to gather and weep and wail as they see Jesus walk past. They arrive at the place dramatically named the Skull, and there Jesus is crucified between two others. Jesus says, "Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they are doing." Crucifixion was designed to be a spectacle. The Roman authorities would set up the vertical bar outside the city limits, and it would remain there day after day, serving as a warning, always ready to be used. If you're sentenced to crucifixion, in effect, you're being cast out of your community, out of the Roman Empire. Not just anybody was crucified. No, crucifixion was reserved for those few who tried to subvert Roman imperial order, tried to resist it, bring it down. Without such a deterrent, the Romans feared their society, their way of life, would fall apart. Turns out the empire was kind of fragile. This was considered necessary to maintain the peace. Only through terror could life go on as normal. Crucifixion was the worst punishment they could inflict. The Roman authorities would take everything away from such a person, stripping them naked and vulnerable for all to see. They chose a method of death that would take a long time, becoming this drawn-out, shameful spectacle. In fact, it was so shameful that it was something people wouldn't want to talk about. It was something you'd try not to look at in case you were contaminated. But it was hard not to look, hard to avoid the bodies, the smell. Luke doesn't go into all the details of a crucifixion. He skirts around it as well, probably because he knows or expects that the people reading this gospel will get it. What he does record is what Jesus says. I don't know how Jesus manages to speak, but he does. And he offers words of grace, words of forgiveness. Even as the guards are scrambling and fighting over his clothes, even as people sneer, laughing at the absurd sign hanging above his head, "This is the King of the Jews," he forgives. There are two other criminals also being crucified that day, and they speak to Jesus. One throws insults at him. The other begs Jesus to remember him. And again, Jesus extends mercy, promising the man that he too will be with Jesus in paradise. A spectacle should jolt you. In 1978, Ta-Ching Hsi built a 9-foot square cage and lived in the cage for a year. He did nothing in that cage. No reading, no watching TV, no other person to talk to, just letting time pass by. Once a week, he was on public display. People could visit and gaze at him in the cage. Photographers captured him in his cage. Some of us might feel like we are him at the moment, stuck in our houses. But he wanted to make a statement. He says we spend so much time filling up our lives with things and activity to try and create some meaning. But what happens when you do the opposite? When you resist by emptying your life? Maybe you realize how fragile your way of life is. Maybe all these things you're doing aren't that meaningful after all. This is kind of what's happening in Luke's gospel. Jesus challenges the spectacle of crucifixion. He turns it into something different than what the Roman authorities are intending it to be. We are invited to turn our attention to the cross and look. Look how violent we can be. How cruel we can be to others. The prisoner on the left of Jesus declares, "This man has done nothing wrong. He is innocent. And yet here is Jesus, like so many before and after him, who die at the hands of the state and are not actually guilty, but innocent." Jesus' crucifixion subverts the idea that the way to peace is through terror. The cross speaks about a love that is willing to sacrifice for others. It speaks about a person who did not cling onto their own life but surrendered it for others. It speaks about a forgiveness that is so powerful because it comes from the lips of a man who is being deeply wronged. This subversion is almost lost to us because now there are crosses harmlessly everywhere that we forget what it was supposed to mean. Then this happens, verse 44. It was now about noon, and darkness came over the whole land until 3 PM, for the sun stopped shining, and the curtain of the temple was torn in two. Jesus called out with a loud voice, "Father, into your hands I commit my spirit." When he had said this, he breathed his last. The spectacle ends. There is darkness, the tearing of the veil in the temple that was designed to keep some distance between God's holiness and the people, now gone. And then Jesus stops breathing, and he's dead. Into this silence, one centurion who's been watching it all finds himself saying, "Surely this was a righteous man." It seems so sad and unfair. But one last note of grace. Jesus' body is not tossed into a common grave like normal. Instead, a man named Joseph, who is part of the Sanhedrin, the Jewish ruling council who pushed for Jesus' death, is unhappy with the decision the council made. So he defies them by asking Pilate for the body. Pilate agrees, and Joseph comes, takes the body down, wraps it in linen cloth and places the body into a tomb cut in the rock. He seals it shut. Jesus is given an honorable burial, but not an honorable death. The day ends, and everyone goes home to mull over what they have just witnessed. This is what we've been inviting you to do this morning, to look, to reflect. What does all this say about God? How does gazing at the cross in this moment of time speak to this moment of time? I want to encourage you to keep looking. Look at artworks of how this story has been depicted. Read Luke 23 again. Meditate on this cross and hear God speak to you afresh.